This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on PodClips. Masters of Dispute Resolution is designed to provide those involved in the mediation process with the views of the most experienced and accomplished mediators and others experienced in the process. Through our discussions, you will gain insight into how to address and overcome difficult issues and achieve more satisfying results in mediation. Your host is Len Levy, mediator and arbitrator with ADR Services, Inc., a leading alternative dispute resolution provider. Lynn litigated complex cases for more than 30 years and has been a mediator since 1998 and is a member of the National Academy of Distinguished Neutrals. He has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution each year since 2014. And now your host, Lynn Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us on Season 4 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast which will add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by the National Academy of Distinguished Neutrals and ADR Services, Inc. Now, in each episode, you're going to hear a story about a conflict, the impact that conflict had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was reached, and lessons to be taken from that conflict and its resolution. Now, many of the details of the story you're about to hear have been modified to preserve the confidentiality essential to mediation, while also conveying the essence of the conflict and its resolution. Today, we're going to be discussing the aftermath of a viral video and the police and the impact the event had on the videographer. So, this episode, I am so pleased to have back Phyllis Chang. We've become friends and I just love interacting with Phyllis, and I'm sure you will as well. Phyllis is just an amazing person. You can, if you had the video, available, you'd see a number of wonderful art pieces that Phyllis has made. And if you want to see them, book Phyllis for a mediation and you'll see it in the background. So now for nearly 7 years, Phyllis was director of the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, the DFEH, which is the largest state civil rights agency in the United States. Phyllis oversaw numerous settlements, some into the six or seven figures, including some of the largest settlements in DFEH history. She was also a senior appellate court attorney, a deputy attorney general with the Civil Rights Enforcement Section of the California Department of Justice, a partner in DLA Piper's employment practice, and a two-term commissioner and vice chair of the Fair Employment and Housing Commission. I could go on, but I think you want to hear from Phyllis more than you want to hear from me. So, Phyllis, today you have an incredible story, and you were the mediator, and it was a story that has a very timely and compelling background. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Phyllis.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Len. Always a pleasure to be a guest on your show. I want to let you know that, you know, sometimes in mediation, what we find is a microcosm of what's happening in the world. So this particular case had to do with a woman who videotaped a takedown of a suspect who was hiding from the police on the night of the George Floyd protests in Los Angeles. She saw in the darkness a man hiding behind a trash receptacle, a trash bin area of a store, which was just behind her house. And she and her son started immediately videotaping the takedown. And what they saw in the dark was a man who was thrown down to the ground by several police officers. They heard the struggle. They heard some force being used by the police. And afterwards, They posted it on social media thinking that this is exactly what happened to George Floyd, and we're going to do the right thing, which is to share this with the public. And after the video went online, the police, of course, came to interview her and her son because they were eyewitnesses to the event. And their report contradicted what the police said. The police said that the man who was taken down did not cooperate with the police, that when he was on the ground, he refused to put his hands behind his back and he had them under his stomach as he was lying flat. Of course, it was dark, so the video actually didn't show whether his hands were behind his back or not. But nonetheless, the citizen and her son who videotaped it believed that he was cooperating. So their version of the story was different from the police's investigation report. After this happened, according to the citizen, she had allegedly threatening phone calls or hang-up phone calls in the middle of the night at her house. She saw police driving by her house. She said that her son, while he was driving in the neighborhood, he would be stopped by the police. And as a result, she became extremely paranoid, agoraphobic, had PTSD, she said, anxiety, panic attacks, and she couldn't even go out. And after that, she had to take a 4-month leave from work, and her son had to move out of state. So that was her story.
So her perception was that the police had reacted to what to the posting of that video, and her coming up with a different version. That was her conclusion.
That's correct. Her conclusion was that she was being harassed because her version of what she saw was different from what the police said happened.
Wow. So that led her to do what? What was the way that she initially approached resolving this on her own, if she did?
Well, she contacted a lawyer. Mm-hmm. It was the same lawyer who represented the man, the suspect who was being pursued. And they basically filed 2 civil rights lawsuits in federal court. And I had the privilege of mediating both those cases.
Okay. Those were, I assume, on separate days.
No, the same day, 1 in the morning and 1 in the afternoon.
Wow.
And both settled, I'm happy to say.
All right. Well, before we get into the mediation, let me just ask you briefly, the effect on her life was that you said that she became agoraphobic and suffered from what she had termed PTSD. But was there, did she lose a job? Did anything like that happen to her?
No, she didn't lose her job, but she did take 4 months of protected disability leave from her job. And so that occurred. She also spent money out of her own pocket to install security cameras throughout her property so that she would be able to see if she was being surveilled.
So regardless of whether the police, and we'll get to what the police maintained in this conflict, but regardless of what the police said, her perception was followed up by some actions on her part that reflected a perhaps a sincere belief that she needed all of this stuff, right?
She absolutely had a sincere belief that she was being retaliated against for having posted the video.
Wow. Okay. We are going to take a break. And when we get back, I think we're going to get into what the police attitude was and going into the mediation. I'm Len Levy. We're on Masters of Dispute Resolution, and we have the privilege today of talking once again with Phyllis Cheng.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and my guest is Phyllis Chang, and I'm at the edge of my chair about what happened. What was the police attitude about the whole dispute?
Well, I think the backstory is important. So what the citizen who filmed the video did not see is that prior to the dispute, there was a huge George Floyd protest and riot in certain parts of the city. And the police got a message to go to the area of the riot. And there were many, many people coming into this drugstore on camera, looting the store and wrecking havoc. So when the police arrived, apparently at that time, the suspect and all of his companions had been videotaped within the store and leaving the store. So they hopped into their car, SUV, and tried to speed away from the police who were in the parking lot. They ran over the foot of an officer. And so the police gave chase. And all along this boulevard, which was a mixed residential and commercial area, there were cameras on store. So the entire chase was videotaped at night. So what you see on the video and what the police saw was that the getaway car was driving at extremely high speed, like 75 miles an hour through a residential and commercial area.
Wow.
Ran onto the median and crashed into a tree. So on the video, you could see about four or five people running out of the car, and they chased this particular suspect who ran behind a trash bin in a store, which is behind the citizen's house. So when the police approached the suspect, they told him to lie down on the ground and put his hands behind his back. He did go on the ground. However, according to the police, he refused to put his hands behind his back and instead put them under his stomach. So in that way, the police are trained to think that he could be holding a weapon under his body. And so they pounced on him, and they might have, you know, there might have been some hitting and kicking as well. There was a lot of noise, a lot of protests, and eventually they were able to apprehend the man. So according to the police, this was a serious crime that was happening. They gave pursuit. They followed protocol. They told this man to put his hand behind his back. He failed to do so, and they did use force that under their training, this is not excessive force. So this was all of this the citizen did not see. All she saw was just the takedown itself. It was dark, and she did not see whether the man put his hand behind his back or under his tummy. So anyway, this is what the police saw. And when the police learned that there was a video put on the internet, they had to go interview the eyewitness, which this woman and her son were. They went to her house. They interviewed her. And they followed up according to the way they were trained. So they felt the police version of the events was that they did what they were trained to do, and they were not targeting this woman. She was an eyewitness, and they had to interview her.
So we're talking about something different than the suspect, and that was the companion case, so to speak, that you also mediated. But we're talking about the case of the citizen who took the video. The thought occurred to me, did the police have cameras on their person? And if they did, were they activated?
That was not the part of the video that I saw. They may have had cameras. They probably did because it was such a wild night of a rioting in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. But certainly when they interviewed the citizen, the woman who took the video, they did not have cameras on. There was no reason to, I mean, they were just interviewing a witness, but they did take notes.
Oh, right. I was referring to the actual incident of the, that was videotaped by the citizen. I didn't know whether the police had cameras and were able to say to the citizen, no, our body cameras show something different.
I don't think I saw any body cam videos. I only saw the videos of the getaway, the crash, and other videos taken of the incident, but not any body cam videos.
So, but the important aspect of the dispute we're talking about now is not necessarily whether the police were correct or incorrect in what they did from the standpoint of the arrest. It was the aftermath that caused the woman to have to take time off from work, have her cameras installed at her house. Exacerbated, if I understand correctly, by the fact that her son was also pulled over at a separate incident?
Yes, yes. I think that for most citizens who have not had any contact with the police, posting a video about alleged police brutality on the internet is something that they feel it's a risky thing to do. And then when the police come calling to investigate, they feel worried that perhaps the investigation had more to do with their having offended the police or contradicted the police. And it put her on a kind of more sensitive notice about all that. And when her son was driving around the neighborhood and pulled over, all of these incidents together made her feel, rightly or wrongly, that she and her family were being targeted simply because they were eyewitnesses and posted the incident on the internet.
Was there also any allegation that they were being targeted because of their race, or was that not a part of it?
Well, everybody, the suspect, the citizen, and her son, they were all African Americans. You know, it was a civil rights case. Mm-hmm. I don't think they necessarily claim that because, you know, even under the civil rights case, just the, you know, harassment, retaliation, and so forth, for the very act of having posted the video, that was enough. They did talk about it in the course of the mediation, that all of this had to do with race discrimination and harassment. And in their minds, this just validated what the world saw on TV about George Floyd. Right. To them, the same thing was happening in their own neighborhood and to them.
Well, so the lawsuit is filed, and at the time the lawsuit is filed, with this particular lawsuit, the one with the video and the posting and the aftermath that was perceived, after that, were the parties ordered to attend a mediation? I know federal cases, there is a component of choosing a method of dispute resolution short of trial.
Both of these were private mediations, and the parties elected to go to private mediation to resolve this case. This was also during the pandemic, and the courts were pretty much not operating as usual. So there was a huge waiting line. And in order to get this case and other cases resolved, many parties chose to go into mediation. And this did expedite the ability for the parties to get the whole issue resolved.
Okay. Well, we're going to take another break, and then we're going to get into the mediation and everyone's attitudes going in. I'm Len Levy. We're on Masters of Dispute Resolution and chatting with Phyllis Cheng. We'll be back in a moment.
Masters of Dispute Resolution is sponsored by the National Academy of Distinguished Neutrals. NADN is the premier invitation-only association of civil mediators and arbitrators in the United States, with members in every state of the nation. Only experienced ADR professionals who are widely acceptable to local plaintiff and defense firms are invited to join the Academy's roster. The Academy's website, NADN.org, is the most widely visited neutrals database in the world today, with over 40,000 law offices, insurance companies, and corporations visiting our free website annually. Firms can search for neutrals by many criteria, including location, case expertise, qualifications, language skills, and most NADN members also publish their available dates, calendars, online, making NADN.org the go-to website for law firms wishing to schedule appointments online with their preferred mediators. For more information, please visit www.nadn.org today.
Welcome back, everyone, to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and we're chatting with Phyllis Cheng. The case that Phyllis has so far told us about is now at the point where the parties have chosen one of the alternative dispute resolution options, which in this case is mediation. And everyone goes into a mediation with some attitude. At least that's been my experience. What were the attitudes of the parties going in?
Well, I think there was a lot of distrust. On the part of the citizen, she did not trust the government. She did not trust the police. And she wanted to be sure that she could talk to somebody who would listen to her, who would believe her story, who would make her feel understood. On the part of the government felt, well, you know, it was a very violent and difficult time in the community with the George Floyd protest. They were in active pursuit of a crime that was happening as they were chasing the suspect. They needed to go speak to every eyewitness of the incident of the takedown, especially since there was a video. And according to the police, they did what they were trained to do. They had to do the takedown. They had to investigate the eyewitness. And perhaps they felt that this was exaggerated, that the allegations of PTSD, panic attacks, anxiety, agoraphobia, you know, the 4 months leave from work, the son having to move out of state because of this one video, that they might have felt this was exaggerated.
And had they taken the citizen's deposition or anything like that leading into this?
It was still early on in the litigation, but however, they had taken her statement, they had interviewed her. I think that's all that happened. I don't think that much litigation had gone on in the case.
But the statement that they took had to do with the incident. What I'm wondering is, did they delve into the police delve into the allegations of harassment? Did they have a chance to question her about that, about the effect of that and what happened with the son? Or was this mediation the first opportunity to share that with them?
I believe this was the first opportunity to share the citizen's experience with the government.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned that the citizen went in there, with the attitude that she didn't trust the government. Why was the trust of the government important in this case?
Well, there was just a lot of distrust of the police and therefore the government in general at the time. So she just didn't trust anything they would say. She didn't trust their reports. She didn't trust their motivations. And she felt very strongly that she had done the right thing as a citizen to inform the general public about some wrong that she saw that was happening. And so she felt that she really took some risks herself to do the right thing in her mind.
Okay. So in approaching the mediation, did you give, you gave thought, I'm sure, as to, are the parties going to be meeting separately? Are the parties going to be in a caucus? And what were your thoughts on that? And how did that play out in the mediation?
Well, this was a mediation on Zoom during the pandemic. And both sides in a pre-mediation conference call had preferred to have caucuses only and not to have a joint session. So that's, I followed their preference. And so all of this was done through caucusing on Zoom.
One of the things that occurred to me is that how does a case get settled without some measure of trust? And I don't necessarily mean the other side. There has to be some trust that the mediator, you, engendered in them. Okay. Both sides actually have to have that.
Well, I'm pleased to say that, I developed a strong rapport with both sides, but particularly with the plaintiff here. The plaintiff herself was a very, very active in community affairs. She had volunteered for the mayor's office in her small town, not the city of Los Angeles, but another city within the region. And she was very active in politics, and all her life she had supported civil rights. Now, when I introduced myself to her and when they chose me as their mediator, they knew that I had been director of the state civil rights agency for 7 years, that I had, you know, worked for 3 decades on civil rights issues. And so we connected at that level right away. And she felt excited to speak to somebody whom she perceived as her peer. And that I understood her, that when she said something, she didn't have to explain it. I think we develop a lot of trust between ourselves. Now, on the defense side, I have mediated numerous cases regarding this particular governmental entity and its police, its law enforcement agency. So we had, you know, also a lot of trust through having mediated and settled cases before. And they felt that I could be a true neutral and be impartial. So on the plaintiff's side, that really was the key, because when you quantified her damages, she didn't lose her job. She didn't lose her salary when she took her paid leave. She, the emotional distress was, it was difficult also to quantify. The son moving into another state, well, he might have wanted to move in any event, but this might have expedited his move out of state. And he was doing very well out of state. So all of this meant that even if there had been some liability, that the damages were very limited. Of course, her lawyer came in demanding much higher damages than maybe she could prove up. But nonetheless, because we connected, we were able to resolve the case for a monetary amount that was reasonable in the context of this case. And I have to say that the citizen was very happy. She said, actually, at the end of the mediation, I don't even care what I get. I was so happy meeting and speaking to you. So she felt validated. She felt recognized. She felt acknowledged for who she is, why she posted the video, and for her her commitment to civil rights. So she was very pleased to kind of spoken to somebody who totally understood her. And on the government side, of course, the government was pleased that the case settled for an amount that was not exorbitant.
Okay, so the underlying interest of the government, let's end this and not pay very much, but not really focused on what the other side needed in order to get the matter resolved. So the addressing of the needs of both parties and meeting the needs of both parties, the concept that we use in, that we use in mediation is, kind of a whiff 'em. What's in it for me? All right. Both sides have to have something in it for them to agree to resolve a dispute. What I'd like to ask you, Phyllis, is the difference between what the parties wanted going in and what they needed going in. Can you address that? Because there seems to be a difference here.
Great question, Lynn. I think in every mediation, you can say the parties want to resolve the case for the defendant here, the government. It would like to limit the amount of damages it has to pay out. And for the plaintiff here, the citizen, she would want to maximize the amount of damages, but it was a challenge because her damages were limited. So that's what they needed, some money and the case to settle. What they really needed was something in addition. What the citizen wanted and or needed was acknowledgement, understanding. She needed someone to emote with her. Now, quite frankly, had this case proceeded to court, she would not get any of that because she's never going to be able to have a conversation with a judge or with a jury the way that she can have a conversation with a mediator. So I was able to satisfy some of these other needs of feeling understood, being respected, and being able to spend as much time as she needed to tell her story so that it was a catharsis. So that was something that she needed that we addressed. What did the government need? Well, the government is not an individual, but nonetheless, it's difficult to be in the government. It's difficult to be in the police force. They also needed acknowledgement that they were putting their lives on the line during a very potentially hostile confrontation. They needed to be understood that they were doing something they were trained to do, following rules and procedures which were set down. They also needed some sense of feeling appreciated that they were there, giving us that thin blue line to control law and order in our city on the night that was quite wild. So they also got that additional need addressed in the mediation.
Well, you know what's really interesting to me here is when we go into a mediation, very often we're thinking in terms of what can one side give to the other side? What can both sides give to each other in order to resolve whatever dispute they have? In this case, yes, the government gave some money. That's true. But the true need of the citizen here and the true need of the government here were satisfied by what you as the mediator gave them, not what they each gave each other. I'm misreading this?
I think you're absolutely correct. Sometimes the parties just cannot give each other what they actually need because it goes beyond the scope of it, the lawsuit. Because in the lawsuit, you don't, as one of the prayers for relief, you don't say, and I want understanding and appreciation and respect and an apology. That can never be ordered by a court. But that is something we can do in mediation, kind of as that extra surplus that a neutral can do to provide those needs to the parties. And I think as long as they feel some of those needs are addressed, it really doesn't matter whether it's through a court, and maybe it can never be achieved through the court, but nonetheless, it can be achieved through mediation, and that's what the mediation process can satisfy.
One of the things that we're trying to do here is to give the attorneys that are participating in mediation an idea of things that they might be able to do pre-mediation with their clients that will help them, or actually help the mediator help them. And one of the things that it seems to me that, I mean, there are a lot of attorneys that do delve into this, but what the client really needs to get out of the mediation can sometimes, can actually conflict with what the attorney, wants. And I'm going to give you just a quick example, if I may. I had a mediation, about 2 years ago. It was actually during the pandemic, and during a lull in the pandemic, but, it was an employment case, and there had been a physical confrontation between the employer and the employee at a Christmas party, the employee shoved the employer and was terminated. Okay, so the employee wanted to get money. His attorney wanted to get money because there's a percentage. They had a contingency. But what was being offered by the employer was, I'm not going to pay you a dime, but I will pay your daughter's money. And you set up a trust fund. That's what the employer needed to put it behind him. What did the employee need it? Well, it certainly wasn't what he thought going in. Is there an ability, or is there some tip that you can give attorneys when they're preparing to bring their client into a mediation concerning trying to understand on a deeper level what their client really needs?
I believe that prior to the mediation, an attorney can kind of shift gears a little bit and put on their problem-solving hat rather than their advocacy hat. It's, of course, impossible to completely put it aside, but to try to put on that problem-solving hat and think of this as an opportunity to problem-solve and to use the mediator as a resource rather than just, you know, the mediator is not there to make judgments about the case. The mediator is there to help the parties resolve the case. So looking at the mediator as a resource, as someone you can call upon to resolve this and to provide what your client really needs, which is a big dose of respect and understanding and giving really the client the day, his or her day in court, because, well, when people actually go to court, they don't really get to do any of these things. I think all those things are important. This is just not the forum for advocacy. This is the forum for problem solving, and use the mediator as your friend and resource to make that happen.
And that's an incredibly important point. The difficulty for attorneys is always to maintain their credibility with their client as being someone who is a strong advocate for their position. The attorney, however, can use the mediator, as you've pointed out, to essentially be, and the phrase that I always liked from the time I first got training was to be an agent of reality. All right. This might be what you can achieve, but do even more. And that is understand what the client needs. And if the other side is unwilling to give it. See if there's something that the mediator might be able to do, as you did in this case. You were very perceptive as to what she needed. You followed through on it, and you provided what each side could not provide the other.
I agree. Mediation is that secret sauce right. to satisfying the needs of the parties.
Well, thank you for sharing the recipe for the secret sauce in this particular case, Phyllis. And unfortunately, we are out of time, and we are going to wrap things up at this moment. I want to first ask you, Phyllis, how people who want to contact you for a mediation or otherwise, what's the best way to do that?
The best way is just to go through ADR Services. My case manager is Hayward, so Hayward, H-A-W-A-R-D, at adrservices.com. You can also find me on the ADR Services website. I think those are the best ways of reaching me.
Great. Great. Well, thank you again. And I also thank you, Daryl Wayne, engineer and producer. I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infigen Labs, Inc. I hope you will continue to enjoy the stories we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.